Call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Tuesday, February 2nd, 1 o'clock. Good afternoon. So we're going to do a little bit of organizational business first to adopt the rules for the committee just very quickly, and then we will go into our one public hearing that we have today. So with that, I'm going to open an organizational meeting, and I will seek a motion regarding the committee rules.
Chair Fegg, I move to adopt proposed committee rules.
Representative Bueller has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules, which should be there all in front of you. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes. And with that, I'm going to close the organizational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 4136. And if you want to go ahead and read us the measure, please. Go ahead and come up, Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4136 increases the $500,000 limit on non-economic damages recoverable in wrongful death actions and other statutorily created causes of action to $1.5 million. Direct state court administrator to adjust limit annually on non-economic damages beginning in 2017. Specifies method by which administrator must make adjustment. Declares emergency, effective on passage. This measure has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. And with that, we're going to hear first from Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joseph Gallegos, and I'm State Representative for House District 30. To begin, I want to acknowledge that I'm neither a physician nor a lawyer. And as Representative Greenlick would point out, I haven't played one on TV either. So. But that being the case, I'm really just a regular Joe, average Joe, and a layperson. So I'm really presenting this from that perspective of the people out there who might be affected by this kind of situation. So I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4136, the bill to increase the cap on compensation for grieving families who have had a loved one killed or lost through negligence. At the informational hearing you heard from the attorneys and from the medical community today, I would like to make sure you hear from families who have been affected by this arbitrary cap. Just for the record, I do want to remind us that a similar bill was brought forth in 2009, and it passed the House 55-4, but then got stalled in the Senate on the other side, as we know that happens sometimes. Again, just to identify the and talk about the bill itself, I just want to share with you my own personal story with regard to this kind of situation. I lost two children, two babies, through premature birth, and it was amazing. Both of them actually came at 24 weeks. The first time was 1972, and my wife and I, in those days, you know, you didn't really question. We didn't question physicians and medical practice as we do now. Clearly, we were also traumatized, so, you know, we didn't pursue anything at the time. The second time it happened, 1987, the same year that this $500,000 cap was set in Oregon, my wife was having difficulty during her pregnancy and went into labor at 24 weeks. My son was born, lived for about an hour. And after that, you know, we visited the doctor's office, and it was interesting because, you know, he literally told us, you might have a case here. But again, we were so traumatized, you know, we were not going to pursue anything. It just, so it's that kind of situation where, and we're not talking about, you know, explainable, reasonable kinds of practices that end up in accidents. We're talking about wrongful death, and clearly that means that something wrongful needs to be proved in court. Another situation personally, again, was my mother in 1991, so just a couple of years after this. Just a regular office procedure was supposed to have taken place, but something went wrong, a mistake was made by the physician, and she died 6 weeks later. And so, it, again, the trauma, the grief we had, just we weren't going to pursue anything, and we didn't. But I guess my point is to recognize here that we're talking about children, and we're talking about women, we're talking about the elderly who are disproportionately affected by these kinds of situations. And this bill would really just rectify 30 years since we've implemented this cap in 1987 at 500,000. It would raise it to 1.5 million, which it would, is really basically keeping track with inflation. So I do want to comment also that this bill is not about punishing anyone. It's about reasonable compensation for the loss of a loved one and the companionship and even financial contribution that they might have made had they not suffered a wrongful death. The trauma that families face when a loved one is killed is compounded by the torture of having the value of their loved one minimized and trivialized. We have a chance to help grieving families today and to gain a measure of justice. Today you're going to hear, you'll see a video, you'll also hear from some other folks who can probably address the more technical aspects of this bill more than I. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Representative, I'm curious, why 1.5? Why not
again,
one? Why
said,
not uncapped?
It's an amount after 30 years basically figured on the rate of inflation. And apparently it comes out to about the same within a few dollars.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative. I think we're going to show a couple of videos.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Videos are very quiet. We have them as loud as they will go.
All right, the videos are very quiet. They're going to be as loud as, they'll already be as loud as we can, so we'll probably need to just be quiet.
I'm Tina Lane, and I'm Andrew Lane's mother. Andrew was my son and at work and passed away from using a 5-pound enclosed box truck at his hospital because they didn't supply alcohol. It was the youngest of my kids. I had three kids. And he was my baby. And my whole life was changed as he saw. All the part, Andrew's family.
And they were working in at a house on the other side of Sandy, which was way out. It seems to me my husband said it was about 30 miles out. So it was kind of hard to take him to Sandy to use the bathroom.
Not to mention the house that they were working on had 7 bathrooms in it. And it had a couple outbuildings that had bathrooms in them. It's pretty simple. Let my son go to the bathroom and he would have came home that day. When I found out there was a cap on it, I was appalled. Totally appalled. That's all anybody, not just my son, but every other people's sons or daughters or mothers or brothers, you know, that have lost their family due to senseless things that could have been easily resolved
and avoided.
And $500,000 is not enough to make them think, wow, what did I do? You know? It's not enough to make that person that was responsible for several lives. When you have a business, you're responsible for those people who work for you. And with that cap on there, that just gives them permission to do exactly what that man did.
And the week after it happened, he wanted my husband to come back. My husband took a leave of absence, but he wanted him to come back and drive the same truck. Just like it was nothing.
Yeah, because it was, wasn't no skin off his nose. He still had a life to live. They could totally put a stop to it by this, by Andrew's story and by anybody else that has been in this very same position. That's what we want. We want them to remember. We want that cap raised so they remember, you know, that there's people's lives are in danger, you know. And when something like that happens, they need to be held responsible for it.
And people's lives were worth way more than $500,000.
Well, my son might not be able to come back, but gosh darn it, if I can help somebody else's son come home, makes it all worth it.
My name is Melissa Jensen. This is my daughter, Bailey. We live here and we're in my home in Eugene, Oregon. We're here because I want to tell our story. Our story that was, it is a tragic time in our life. Almost 8 years ago, we lost my husband, Sean, due to a medical problem that was unexpected. We had three daughters, Bailey, Savannah, and Jasmine. Bailey was 15, Jasmine was 6, and Savannah was 8. My husband and I were together from the time we were 18 and 19. We were young parents with Bailey. We tried to work hard and provide for our family. He was a stay-at-home dad for many years because that was the best choice for our family. And when it came time to put that value on him, I don't think there's a reasonable way that you can look at what we lost. There's lots of things that we lost. His knowledge, his love, his help for our family, the things that he would have taught our younger girls that Bailey had the opportunity to learn from him, whether it be driving skills, working on our house, working on our automobiles, his work. He was just back to work because our youngest started kindergarten. And although he was a stay-at-home dad for many years, we were just starting to get on our feet. I couldn't have understood almost 8 years ago the emotional devastation that it would have on the kids. Grief isn't something you can measure. The loss of someone, the memories you have 8 years later that if dad would be here, he'll never have the opportunity to walk any of his daughters down the aisle. He'll never have the opportunity to teach Bailey's younger sisters how to drive. He will never have the opportunity to live a life with me without children and enjoy our time together. It's a difficult situation that I don't believe anybody can stamp a dollar amount. Having a cap of $500,000 that you put that max value on someone's life is a tragedy in itself, because almost 8 years later, money can't replace what they would have brought to the table, but we've needed help. I've been a single mom of three kids, and I needed help. I needed help with my home. I needed help with my cars. I needed help with my kids. I had to change my living because it wasn't enough to support the kids. I really feel it's important to allow our system to work. And in all honesty, I think the caps being in place is what gives them that ability to make that kind of offer, because they know there's a maximum. And so, you know, they'll lowball, hoping that you'll be intimidated enough to accept it. And fortunately, with my strength and with my three kids in mind and my wonderful attorney, it just wasn't going to happen. I know many people face losing everything they have because of the financial devastation. Fortunately, I did have the good job and provided a lot of the wages, but he provided the care of our children, which you can't put a value on. Staying home with them, making sure they were fed, being here to put them on the bus. Those were things that he did. That's real life. I needed him. And it's really important to understand that saying someone's life is only worth a maximum of $500,000 impacts the family and puts them in another emotional devastation, because you can't put a dollar amount. You don't know what your kids will need. You don't know what you will need by not having that person there. It's hurtful.
Okay, and with that, you did receive some written testimony from Arthur Towers from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I think that, from my understanding, is this was an attempt to kind of deal comprehensively with some of the issues that were raised at the informational hearing. So we're actually going to stand at our ease a moment just so we all have a chance to kind of pick through this testimony, because I don't think it was on OLIS. It's right here in front of us. And then I think, Arthur, if you... I know that you don't necessarily want to testify, but you, if anybody have any questions, maybe on this. So we're going to stand at ease for a moment. Okay, we're back in session. And actually, I just learned that there are a couple people who are waiting to testify before going to another committee. So we will have Mr. Towers come up if you guys have any questions. But first, I want to have Kate Newhall and Bob Junedep.
All right. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today with Family Forward Oregon. And we're happy to be here today testifying in support of House Bill 4136 to increase what we think is an arbitrarily low cap on non-economic damages in wrongful death cases. We see this as a very important issue for women and for mothers who we know still are paid less than their male counterparts, and as a result, whose lives actually aren't valued equally when they die due to someone else's negligence. As you saw in the video, this is an even more dramatic disparity when talking about parents who stay at home. Unfortunately, equal work for equal pay is still a far-off reality for most women. Wage discrimination can take many forms, but we still know that women make 78 cents on the dollar that a man earns. And this is even more extreme for women of color. An African-American woman makes 64 cents on the dollar, compared to 56 cents on the dollar for a Latino woman. And this is true for work across all industries. For example, in occupations with most people working full-time, year-round, women are still paid less than men. In sales occupations, women are paid 63 cents on the dollar as men. In production, it's 68 cents. In management, 78 cents. Right now, Oregon women and families are being shortchanged thousands of dollars a year because of this pay gap, and that compounds over the course of a lifetime. Under Oregon law, the non-economic damages in wrongful death cases are capped, while the economic damages are not capped. This means, and I think one of the issues that's most important for Family Forward, and why we believe in this bill and this change, is that when a grieving family loses a stay-at-home parent or a parent who only works part-time because they've chosen to take time to care for their children, or a woman who is just paid substantially less than her male counterparts, will only get minimal compensation for her loss. And for stay-at-home parents, like I said, this is even more extreme. For them to have a $0 value placed on that life, I think discounts all of the contributions that that parent makes to the household economy, to the child care. So I think this arbitrary cap on non-economic damages, to us, has the effect of valuing a woman's life as less than a man's life. We see this as an important component of addressing pay inequality within Oregon, and a step towards recognizing the true value of a woman's work, both at home and in the workplace. With that, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today and testify on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. We're a nonprofit law office in Portland that is funded by the federal government to protect and advocate for the rights of people with disabilities. We do not do personal injury law ourselves, and so we really don't have any direct fiscal stake in the outcome of this bill. However, in the course of our work, we deal with families as well as individuals with disabilities, the whole range of disabilities. Those disabilities can arise at birth, they can arise at youth, and in adulthood, and many times as the result of traumatic injury. And when there is a traumatic injury, if there is fault in that injury, we believe as a matter of justice for the individual and the families, as well as a recognition of the very essential role that families play in the future of people with disabilities, in their well-being and in quality of life, and the fact that if they do not receive adequate care during that period, they will end up invariably as recipients of public benefits in order to provide that care. I'll give one example. I sit on the governor's traumatic brain injury task force. We'll have a report for you during this session. But one of the things that we've done is gone around the state and received testimony from families about the impact of an acquired traumatic brain injury on the entire family. And I can just tell you that it's devastating. Our systems are not designed to provide public support for those individuals to adequately address the impact of that type of injury. It's life-changing for the entire family, and recognizing that level of injury is something that our justice system should take into account, and having an arbitrary cap on those damages, in other words, not allowing the amount of damages that a jury determines or a judge determines to be appropriate in the situation, but in fact capping them arbitrarily at a low rate does not do justice to what those families need to adjust to. So for those reasons, we fully support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Okay, seeing none. Joshua Nosby, you want to come up quickly because I know that you just have kind of a discrete issue so you can get out of here.
Thank you. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nosby and I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator in the Oregon Judicial Department. Judicial Department is neutral on the bill and I'm here to talk to you about a very boring procedural issue. You'll see in Section 2 that the bill directs the State Court Administrator to adjust the cap for inflation on an annual basis. While that's not what I would characterize as a traditional judicial function, it is something we do under current law with the caps in the Tort Claims Act. And so I'm here today to ask you to align the process in the bill with the process under the Tort Claims Act. And in a nutshell, that means amending the March 1 date in the bill to change that to July 1. There's two reasons. One's a simple efficiency purpose. If we're doing this in July, we'd like to do everything at once and make all the adjustments. The second involves the timing of the release of the CPI. And historically, it's come late enough in February that it has would cause us challenges and potentially shrink the period for public comment. So again, we're just asking that the bill be amended to replace March with July. And I've spoken with the proponents of the bill, and I understand they're comfortable with it. So I won't take any more of your time and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. Any questions for Josh?
Thank you.
With that, we'll have J.L. Wilson, Brian Boehringer, and Scott Winkles.
Is this yours? Do you know whose amendment this is?
Claim.
Oh, is he going to come testify on it? Or?
I'm not sure.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the Doctors Company and Physicians Insurance, who in combination with CNA insures most of the doctors in the state, as well as the broad business coalition you see on the material in front of you. I'm just going to resubmit the material that was given to you during legislative days and just reiterate some of that information and then maybe a little bit of new stuff from our perspective. Just for purposes of background, obviously there are unlimited economic damages for lost wages, earnings, medical costs, and any other conceivable economic losses ensuing from a wrongful death claim. Also available unlimited punitive damages, particularly in egregious cases, of which 30% statutorily is committed to the prevailing party. And then you have the $500,000 cap on non-economic damages that are available in wrongful death claims. The chart that shows the states in the West, I think, shows that Oregon's $500,000 cap is far from arbitrary. Actually, most Western states have caps on non-economic damages that are actually less than Oregon's. I think you could classify that Oregon's is in the upper tier, actually, of Western states. You've got some states down as low as $200,000 and $250,000. And one thing that I would point out is that the 9/11 Commission set the non-economic damage caps at $250,000 per claim for the terrorist attacks on 9/11. So I would argue that a $500,000 cap on non-economic damage is actually far from arbitrary. It's there for a public policy reason to balance cost and access issues for healthcare providers. Finally, on the chart, I showed you a disparity in the rates stemming from those states on the West Coast where you see a nice juxtaposition of non-economic damage caps. In Washington, you have unlimited caps. In California, you've got 250 $50,000 cap, and in Oregon, of course, the $500,000 cap. And the disparities in liability insurance rates, especially in the high-risk professions, is striking. And you can see the difference there and its correlation to non-economic damage caps. I think I'll conclude by saying that the doctor's company and physician's insurance are committed to the EDR process, or what's called the EDR process here in Oregon, the early discussion and resolution process. That's a part that was a consequence of the 2013 legislative session, which was an attempt to get people sort of in a mediated setting prior to going into filing a civil claim. The reason I think that this is important, and keep in mind, we went into that process advocating for real tort reform. Tort reform did not occur, and this EDR process took its place. And the legislature is invested in it. But the reason we're invested in it is because it's $110,000. It costs the healthcare system $110,000 for every civil injury claim that's opened in our state, 80% of which are closed with no liability. So it is a cost driver, and it's a cost driver for defensive medicine. Medical malpractice rates in Oregon today are relatively stable. They are close to 2005 levels, and that's because there's just been an intense focus on safety, and that's coming through with reduced claims frequency, and that's why you see the stable rates. Our point is, if you increase the non-economic damage cap and consider a threefold increase, you will incentivize folks not just to not only go to bypass the EDR process, which I don't think would be the right thing to do, but you also then start to see claims frequency increase, which is reflected in the liability rates. And of course, our argument is that liability rates translate into access, particularly for high-risk professions and also particularly in rural areas. They are related. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and Mr. Bovet couldn't be at the hearing today. We're all double booked, but he has asked that I also represent that our views are the same as the Association of Oregon Counties. The cities of Oregon are primarily self-insured. City County, we operate, League of Oregon Cities in conjunction with AOC operate, as for lack of a better word, a joint venture health insurance, self-insured health insurance pool. And we are concerned that the troubling of the damages and the retroactive nature of the bill would provide a direct pressure on our on the health providers we contract with to increase costs. We believe that the caps are there for a very logical and good reason, and it provides predictability and rates. And so I think passage of the bill in its current form, we believe, would increase employee health insurance costs for our employees.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Bering with the Oregon Medical Association. We represent over 8,000 physicians and physician assistants that practice across the state and in your districts, and we're here to oppose House Bill 4136. First, I want to express our sympathy to the families and reiterate that OMA believes there should be economic and reasonable non-economic remedies available in these cases. You have my written testimony, and you heard from our content experts 2 weeks ago, so I'll be really brief. Oregon currently has a reasonable limit on non-economic damages for wrongful death. Caps are used to control costs and provide a stable insurance environment which allows our members to sustain their practices. Specifically, we remain concerned that if the cap is increased, liability costs will go up and providers in high-cost areas like rural Oregon will struggle to maintain practices. This could also increase costs for the state because they currently fund the Rural Medical Liability Reimbursement Program. If rates increase and funds to the subsidy do not, we could see rural providers and specialties like obstetrics leave their practices. The reason the state has a Rural Medical Liability Program is that after the Lakin decision, we did see premiums go up and rural specialty providers couldn't afford to maintain practices. The program was created in 2003 and it's maintained today to offset those costs. Finally, let me close by saying this is a very tough issue, a very, very tough issue that has been discussed here for 7 years, and it's a tough issue to solve in a short session. It's hard to quantify non-economic damages, and it's hard to balance the need to have statewide access to providers with fair settlements to families that have suffered a loss. And that is exactly why the OMA and the Trial Lawyers Association sat down together in 2013 and created the Early Discussion and Resolution Program. The EDR program was developed to address adverse outcomes, including death. This was an attempt to chart an alternate path to get more of these cases out of the legal system, focused on fair resolutions for participants, and let the healthcare system learn from its mistakes. The program has only been up and operating since July of 2014, and we are just now to see claims work their way through the process. Excuse me. So instead of raising this cap, let's give EDR a chance to work. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Question for this, Representative Stark.
Thank you. And thank you, Chair. I forgot your name at the end. I'm sorry.
Brian,
since you just, I was trying to figure out who to ask this question of as I sat here thinking about this. You mentioned the rural medical practitioners.
Yes.
And do you know, as far as Oregon, our state budget, what effect that would have on our budget? Because to my understanding, that they're reimbursed on a percentage of their subsidy, or their subsidy percentage of their premiums.
Correct.
And therefore, wouldn't that affect our state budget, or would we just not be able to give as many people? What effect would that have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stark, I think that's up to the legislature. You know, they fund the program at a certain level that covers the participants currently in it. If the cost of the program were to go up, if the legislature decides to provide additional funds, then the program would be maintained. If they don't, then we would simply not have as many participants in the program. So access would go down.
I'll just note, in reference to your question, the fiscal impact for the bill is in, because we were scheduled for a work session today, and it says it has minimal fiscal impact.
Chair, may we verify that they took that into account in determining that? Because this was just brought to my attention, so I don't know. Sometimes we assume and we miss things like that. Is there a way to verify that they actually considered that impact?
I don't know.
Or what result that would have on our ability to provide for people?
I don't know if that was considered or not.
I don't know.
Go ahead. Did you have a follow-up?
No. That was my main question.
Okay. Representative Holby.
I'll pass. I found the answer to my question.
Thank you.
Okay,
great. Other questions? Representative Rayfield.
So I guess I've talked to a couple of attorneys, and thank you guys for being here. You guys do a great job in the building, so and Brian, I've always respected you immensely. One of the questions has been on that dispute resolution issue, and that's something I've heard from numerous folks, and obviously I'm a practicing attorney. I've engaged in a dispute resolution. I have a certificate in dispute resolution. I've spoken with many attorneys on this very issue, and none of us can figure out why anybody would not want, if we have a case that is viable, if we believe that there was wrongdoing and both folks want to come together to work on a settlement, it doesn't really matter what a case is worth if you want to try and settle it. And so I mean, just in all genuine seriousness, I honestly don't understand that argument. And so from us, like as I sit on this side, without being able to understand it, I don't want to say it's misleading. I'd try like to better understand it, because from an attorney's perspective, if you have a valid case, you want to participate in something like this, because there's no client in their right mind ever wants to be in a courtroom. And quite frankly, no doctor in their right mind wants to ever be in a courtroom, or I don't care if you're a drunk driver, you know, or you know, whatever the situation is, if someone's experiencing the loss, especially, you know, where a family has lost a loved one, you know, having that direct, nobody wants that. People want to come together and do what's right for the family because they're experiencing a serious loss. So I just haven't understood the argument very well, and that could be my ignorance.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, let me take a run at it. I think you're right. It would be great if those cases went into the EDR process. But I think it's safe to say that there's trust issues amongst both sides that participate in that process. And it took a lot of political will in this building to get them at the same table to craft that. And I know from our side, not everybody was universally thrilled with the outcome. And I have heard that it was similar on the other side. So I think anything that sort of divides the community down the road while we're all trying to work on something that everybody kind of agreed to try to get to a different place on these things, I think that erodes trust. And so and I don't know on the other side, but to get folks to participate in the program is a big trust issue.
Okay. And one follow-up. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to lob one tough question at you guys, in all fairness. When I was 8 years old, I was really into Transformers. GoBots,
really tough.
And things like that. And that's when the legislature, when I was 8 years old, put a cap wrongful death when we had a robust policy discussion. I assume I was 8 years old. I was watching Transformers. But at that point in time, that's when we made this change. When, if the time is now, not now to make the change, when do we make the change?
Thank you. I'll take that question.
Short straw, huh, JL?
It's my time in the queue. Thank you, Representative Fagan and Representative Rayfield. See, I had to read your name tag.
Did I make you that nervous? Huh? Forgot my name. I made you that nervous.
It's a tough question, because I would say the $500,000 cap's there for a reason. And if you ask me when it's time to change it, when all the other states decide that they want to change it, and we go alongside, and it's that level of a playing field, then I would suggest that's probably the time to change it. But the reality is, you've got all of our neighboring states, absent Washington, that got caps that are $500,000 or less. Would suggest to me that it's there for a reason, because they value access to medical services and the high risk services. So I'm not sure I would agree there's a time to change it, really.
And just as a point of clarification, the California number is inaccurate, because it only applies to a subset of cases. So you guys should go back and update the map on that, just to kind of,
Representative Fager, this is passed through many layers of attorneys, and so my question is to you, what subset of cases as it pertains to the wrongful death?
Because malpractice.
Malpractice, okay.
Yeah, so I practice down there, so familiar with it.
Okay.
Follow-ups, further questions? Representative McLean, that's right, I'm sorry.
Hi. I'm trying to figure out 1.5. I think it was Representative Stark that said that, and my understanding of the answer that you got was that it we're looking at it since 1986 or 87, and so we're looking at inflation, and I think we do a lot of things by, indexing or looking at cost of living or looking at inflation, and so even though some of these other states, some have caps, some have no caps, some have different caps, some have the same cap, it seems like if this set of folks that brought this to us are looking at something as simplistic as inflation, that would be part of the discussion or talking about it. So can you tell me how you feel either the your costs, are going to change with this particular inflation number being used, or how you're specifically, what is the percentage or what is the gap that you're seeing in your ability to work with this number?
Thank you, Chair Fagan and Representative McLean. I think I will take a stab at this. I am under the understanding that if the cap is indexed by inflation, that there's no real value to the cap over time, and so it would lead to the same escalation in rates as essentially not having a cap. So that's what I've been told by my clients, and so working with the cap eventually is the same as not having a cap at all, actuarially.
You got a little demotion there. Sorry, Brian.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I, the only thing I would add to that is I would love for the inflation number to be checked, because I'm just looking at some testimony from the 2015 session, and there was a different number that was adjusted to $2014 dollars that was just over $1 million. So I just think we should. I didn't see the sourcing for that, and I didn't do the back of the napkin math, but I think we should check that to see if that is $1.5 million.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. I was going to bring this up and see if someone had another answer on the 1.5. I have a great deal of respect for Representative Gallegos, but I pulled up on the United States Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, and punched in the 1987 and the $500,000. And just off of that site, which is up right now, for 2015, that puts it at $1,043,000. So I am curious. So I do question if it was just tied to inflation or if there's another reason for the 1.5. These guys are opposed to the bill, so I'm guessing they wouldn't know where the origin of that is. But I have that same question for whoever's coming up. You might be able to find that out before you come up.
Questions or follow? Oh, go ahead. Follow up.
Thank you. I have one more follow up.
No problem.
So I asked this previously. I've gotten a lot of good answers, by the way, for questions I asked during the legislative days. Maybe you guys have come across one of the answers that I haven't received from anyone is how many of the cases that we've had, do we know how many cases or how often juries award more than the $500,000? I haven't seen that in any of the numbers. So I'm curious how big of an issue this is where the juries are saying it's worth this much and then we say now it's not. I just haven't seen those numbers, if anyone has those.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, we're looking for that number as well. We weren't able to find it in the 2 weeks, so
okay.
We're working on it.
Questions? Yeah, Representative Nierman.
So, Mr. Wilson, maybe you can take this one, but going back to that dispute resolution process, where does that have its origins? Is that used by any other states? And if so, has it been successful or would have been the results in other states?
Thank you, Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman. I don't know the history of it other than what happened here at Oregon legislatively when we were talking about health care reform in sort of a global context, and the cost of defensive medicine and liability costs were integral in those discussions. And so that gave, obviously, the my side, if you will, wanted damage caps and those types of things. The trial lawyers obviously did not. And so where we came to in this process was this EDR that I actually think was something that Dr. Bud Pierce was really advocating for within the ranks of the OMA. But it was needless to say, I think we went into that a little skeptical that it would work. I think we both sides came into it kicking and screaming a little bit because it wasn't at all what we wanted. Mm-hmm. But that was sort of the genesis of the process and those negotiations that happened in basically the 2012 timeframe and was validated by the 2013 legislature.
Hello? Representative McLean.
Well, Representative Stark made me look at some of my other paperwork because he said, I bet this isn't the panel to ask the question that I asked part of it or yours either. And the one that came to us from the folks, yes, on this particular resolution, it says the cap was simply adjusted, if it was simply adjusted by inflation, would be over 1 million. So I think your number is good, the one you found there. It's over 1 million if it's just inflation. But one of the other issues is cap or no cap. I mean, everybody's been talking about that, cap or no cap. This has still got a cap, but it's just increasing the cap. And it's also giving more latitude maybe for real numbers for the juries to deal with. And some of the things that have been interesting to me that I don't think anybody's been talking about is how many of the juries have actually gone over the $500,000 cap and by how much? That's kind of my question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Fagan. I think that was the same exact question that Representative Stark was asking, which was how often do those verdicts happen that are over the cap and then subsequently have to be reduced?
So that, okay. I thought you were answering something else, but okay.
Other questions? Well, I have a question kind of and a comment. So, I mean, I think there's definitely been a lot of discussion. I think from a policy perspective, I don't like caps at all. I just don't like sitting here today having no clue what a grieving person is going through and saying, oh, it doesn't matter what horrific thing you experience and how much suffering you experience, there's no possible scenario in the world in which 12 members of your peers who are looking at all the facts and the data could ever find more than whatever number. To me, that's just an uncomfortable thing for us to sit kind of from our high horse and do. On a practical level, I get why the bill before us has a cap as opposed to no cap. I guess in terms of, and Scott, you mentioned it as well, you know, you talked about, you know, a cap allows for predictability. Well, this is still a cap. And then I guess the part that really troubles me in terms of totally buying the argument that this will just be some horrific increase in premiums such that we would see people leaving the medical profession or at least leaving Oregon is the fact that the vast majority of cases, people are injured more than they die, way more. And in injury, we already don't have a cap. So I guess if you can just flesh that out for me, I don't know what fraction of the cases it is where there's actually a wrongful death as opposed to a, you know, wrongful injury. I don't do these kind of cases, so I don't know the lingo.
why adjusting the cap, you know, sure, it's a tripling of it, but it's still a cap on the small fraction of cases that are wrongful death would somehow dramatically affect the premiums when there's already all the injury cases out there with no cap. That, I guess, I'm just not, that's not computing to me how it would be such a dramatic increase.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the question. I wish I understood better how rates are set. All I know is that there are things that happen out there in the climate that adjust our rates or that change the rates. And when the rates go up, our most troubled areas are the ones we're very concerned about. And so it may be a question that I can bring back from more carrier information because I don't know how the rates are set.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
And just to chime in a little bit, some of the testimony in the informational hearing, if you guys, and I think it would be interesting from the doctor's company perspective, one of the big factors is they had about $4.8 billion, like in total assets, that's actually invested. That's online. You can go in and Google it and look at it. It's part of their reading materials. But as it goes, and they calculate how many reserves, so they estimate what are our reserves, which are essentially how they calculate claims. They subtract that out, and then you get to the surplus, and there's about a $1.8 billion surplus above what they're estimating for reserves. So you have the it could be 4.5, 4.7 billion, whatever it is, 4 something billion, which then leads to the $1.8 billion in surplus. And part of the information was is a big factor, as you can imagine, if that shifts 1% one way or the other, that's a big impact on how rates are. So if you look at the economic downturn, there's some interesting things. There is also an interesting CBO report as you go through where they were kind of looking at do caps actually affect these things. And so I think that, I mean, the doctor's company, if you guys want to present some of that information, that certainly would be helpful for us.
Okay. Further questions or comments?
I think certainly respect the jury process, but we see all the time that juries aren't 100% right in their decision making, and sometimes decisions also are associated with large rewards that most people think are out of proportion with the damages, and I think we've seen some of those cases publicized recently. And I also think that we all take the risk. We could all be sitting in the situation where we have a loved one who has a wrongful death, and we all share that risk of having a cap because we could all be in that situation where you lose a loved one. So I think that's sharing the risk among everyone who lives in our society.
That's a comment. Yeah, President Holby.
Oh, thank you. I mentioned this at the informational hearing, too, a little frustrated because we ask for, you know, data on the number of claims that have been filed or unfiled. And I'm glad Representative Stark got some answers, and maybe I can get some of his answers from him. But just, you know, it's hard to make a decision when we don't have the data about, well, you know, how many of these are malpractice, how many are not, what the... how many claims there are, how many are filed, how many are settled, you know. And so, I mean, that data would have been helpful for me in trying to make a decision about this. So I just want to express a little frustration with not having the data.
And I'll be specific on some data that would be helpful for me. So we know in 1999, the Supreme Court overturned caps in injury cases. I'm assuming, based on what you're telling us today, that there was a percentage of increase of premiums that we saw immediately after that. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but that would be my assumption based on the testimony. Okay, so then I also want to know, you know, of the cases that you pay out, what percentage are injury versus wrongful death? So I think that at least from that information, there might be some ability to project, because you'd say, okay, if it increased this much when... if 95% are injury and it increased this much when 95% saw no caps, and now we're looking at only increasing the cap three times for 5% of the cases, I just think that it would at least give us some numbers to play with, because I agree that it's hard to find it. I mean, for me, the policy issue is a totally different kind of question than these nuts and bolts, what premiums would increase questions, but it's hard to find credible the argument that the sky will fall when we don't get the data that shows that there's some kind of weight and legitimacy to those arguments. So that would be, those specific pieces of data would be helpful for me. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Since we're throwing out specific questions that we're hoping somebody out there has an answer to.
To the universe. Hello, universe.
So some specifics on the rural medical practitioners, you know, subsidy program. I'm very interested. Again, I already mentioned if there's a fiscal. I'm interested in knowing if there's not a fiscal, what are we planning on doing? Because there's only, if we're reimbursing it up to 80% and costs do go up, so either we have to increase our budget or we're reducing who the number of people who get it. So I really want to have an idea what we're planning on doing with that. Another issue on that is my reading of some of the rules on that is that the reimbursements are for policies allowed up to $1 million. And so do we have to pass a different law or change our, you know, our rulemaking? What did the legislature actually say on that? Did the legislature in our laws, or was that rulemaking, cap the policy at $1 million? So do we have to lift that to match 1.5? Or I just want to know what we're doing with that so that we're not having this backlog of, oh, we didn't mean to do that. So there's just a couple.
Any other questions?
I can.
All right, wrap it up.
Yeah, I just directly respond to Representative Stark. The way, and the panel can obviously correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm more than willing to be wrong, but generally the assumption is that's the private market, and if there's a demand for a various given insurance product, that's generally where, you know, they will come up with that product, assuming that it doesn't already exist. So that's it's not something that we did as a legislative body where we said you can only have a $1 million policy. That's a product that has been marketed by an insurance company.
Chair Fagan, I don't mean to turn it
into
a
work session. And I know that Arthur Towers is going to come up as well. I don't want to let these guys totally off the hook if there's some continuing questions.
So,
but
okay. Rafael, what I'm looking at right now is specifically the Rural Medical Practitioners Insurance Subsidy Program Administrative Rules. And so so it's not just a generic policy. This is how you even apply. And so I don't think it's insurance companies saying they have to put it there. Somewhere in administrative rules, we've said this is it. And I don't know if that can easily be changed or if we need to take action to change that.
Yeah, there's – and do you mind if I respond?
Sure.
If there's if you go on –
I think I do.
I would go onto the – like if you go onto the doctor's company website, there's also – you'll see all the different types of – I'm talking about the private market rather than that. And so I just as a point of clarification, they have other products specifically where if you're like a high-risk doctor, you've had multiple claims, you've had your license revoked, you're kind of a high-risk person, you're going to pay higher premiums. So they have actually a separate company that's under the same wing where you would go through and become insured through that group. So it's, you know, and so again, they're trying to tailor the product to what they're doing.
Right. Representative Buehler, close us out.
Give me an idea, JL, what the maximum policy amounts that the doctor's company offers physicians for liability coverage?
I would have to get back. That's something I could answer for you probably very quickly. So I'll make sure to do that probably today.
And if a decision exceeds whatever that coverage is, what happens?
Okay.
All right. Well done. All right, Arthur Towers, are you ready for this? And I don't know that he necessarily has testimony, because he wasn't even signed up to testify. I just thought people might have questions because he has some written materials. So if you have any thoughts based on what we've said so far today, but folks might have questions on your written material.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, and I thought I was here on behalf of Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I now understand I'm here on behalf of the universe, which is why the universe is in trouble, I'm afraid. I did just want to, I think some of the questions that were asked today, I can shed maybe some light on, as well as some of the ones that were asked last time as well. So I do want to dwell 1 second on the 1999 ruling that removed the cap on damages in injury cases. So we actually have 17 or 16 or 15 years of experience around what happens when you remove a cap. And one of the big issues that was raised in the informational hearing was that doctors would leave the state. And in fact, what's happened is the number of physicians in Oregon have increased by 47%, while population has increased by 18% over that 15-year period. And that's held true. I don't want to overstate, not quite across the board, but in 33 out of 36 counties, there's been increases. In 33 counties, the increase has been more than 23% in the last 11 years. In Coos County, the increase has been 15%, and there's been two counties where the number of physicians has decreased. As best as I can tell from looking at the Oregon Medical Board's licensure documents, that's held true across licensing specialties.
If I may just ask
Well, let's let him finish his thought first, and then we'll have open it up for questions.
Very good. It's been said a couple times, but I didn't want to say it one more time, and that is that the early dispute resolution process that has been in place for about a year is designed for injury cases that are, as I said, uncapped. And so why it wouldn't work just as well for death cases with the cap is unclear to me, I guess. We do get bogged down in the on the medical side of this. There are a number of cases that have nothing to do with the medical industry. We do, and we do lose track as we get as we wade through the numbers that what we're really talking about here are grieving families, and grieving families having access to justice. I wanted to get at Representative Stark's question, Representative McLean's question, about the number of times that the jury award exceeds $1.5 million. And that's, we haven't been able to dig up a good number on that, and so I didn't want to come up here and give you a bad number. But I did want to emphasize that the other place that the cap really comes into play is in settlement conversations. And so one of the, Ms. Jepson mentioned in her video that she got lowballed on the offer. And so the offer comes in at, you know, $275,000, knowing that the most they can get is $500,000 if they were to go through the trauma of a lengthy trial. And so that's another place where it comes into play. So it's not just on the upper end, but also in that sort of context as well. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point that out. The other thing that I want to emphasize that's just come out in the last since the informational hearing is the most recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, and in your material, there's a news article about that titled "A Few Doctors Account for Outsized Share of Malpractice Claims." And one in three malpractice claims, according to the New England Journal of Medicine, one-third is attributed or linked to 1% of the physicians. And in the 10-year time period that they were looking at, 2005 to 2014, only 6% of the physicians had a claim paid at all. And so I want to figure out. I have sympathy for Mr. Berenger and his clients, and you know, I would love to partner with them on figuring out how to tackle the insurance company's rate setting practices, because I do think that, you know, I'm again sympathetic to high insurance premiums, and so I do want to, but I do want to emphasize that the number of physicians that are engaged, or again, to be clear about the wording, linked to paid claims is 1% of all physicians over that 10-year period. That's for one-third of the paid claims. Okay. And I guess, and with Representative Holvey's question about number of cases that we're talking about, the other thing that's very difficult to determine when it comes to number of cases is the number of people who never go to trial because they see, you know, Representative Gallegos' story is, you know, one example. People looking at the cap and saying, do we really want to go through with all this, you know, based on the sort of trauma that the grieving family is up against. And so that's where we run into trouble with the counts, or one place that we run into trouble with counts. So I hope that's helpful. There's a variety of charts and graphs back here from a variety of sources, primarily the Oregon Medical Board. So, again, trying to get the committee good information and get at it that way. The last thing that I want to address is the $1.5 million. That was from a bill passed in 1999 by a 55-4 vote back in the day when major issues passed with 55-4 votes, and that passed the House by that margin. The inflation, I'm not current on what the current inflation rate would be. It is over $1 million, but the $1.5 million comes from what there was a bipartisan support for 7 years ago.
Thank you. That was helpful. Representative Buehler.
Arthur, thanks very much for getting data. I like that we're trying to be data-driven here. Can you break out this increase in different Oregon counties in terms of high-risk specialties and what's been going on, especially in our more rural counties? High-risk specialties meaning general surgery, OBGYN, those types of providers, and what's occurred in the last 10 years.
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, the information I was able to pull up readily is the material on the back few pages. That is the medical doctors, osteopaths, acupuncture, podiatry, physician's assistants. Those are ones that were quickly listed.
Yeah, to follow up, Chair. Because I think the concern not so much is how many acupuncturists we have in Harney County, but how many general surgeons and docs who are delivering babies. That is what's really meaningful to those communities, not how many chiropractors we have. So if we could develop that data, that would be really helpful.
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, thank you for the comments. I wanted to get at the comment that was made by Representative Stark at the last at the informational hearing about what happens when a community loses its physician. From what I inferred from that comment, again, maybe not what he meant, but what I took away was a town losing its doctor and kind of drying up. And so I think these statistics belie that. I don't have a reason to believe that, given the large increase in physicians in Oregon, or meaningful increase, and the meaningful increase in the number of doctors in rural areas, that it would be different. But I don't know that for a fact, so I don't want to testify to that.
Yeah, just a point of clarification. These numbers will include non-physician providers, acupuncturists, chiropractors, physician assistants, I assume, based on your comments.
But the on page 3, the chart is MDs by county?
All the MDs.
Correct.
But not broken out by specialty.
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, that'd be correct. But not to hide that number, but that this is what was readily available. We pulled out the other types of medical providers because that was what I could find readily.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. I might have missed this, and I apologize if I did, but a lot of this discussion keeps coming back to medical malpractice, and I was trying to figure out, what percentage of the wrongful death claims are actually related to medical malpractice as opposed to the universe. I don't know that I've heard that yet, and so I'm trying to put this in context of wrongful death.
Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, that is a hard number that I do not have. But in terms of wrongful deaths, there are auto accidents, trucking accidents, mm-hmm. defective products, other types of negligent behavior that leads to death that are far outside the purview of the medical community. So, I won't I won't go there in terms of anecdotes, but as I talk to our members, there's, you know, a meaningful number of medical ones and a meaningful number of non-medical ones too.
And just to
follow up,
and as best I read this, this bill is about all wrongful death, not just medical malpractice. Is that correct?
Chair Fagan, Representative Hulvey, that's exactly correct.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. And Art, I appreciate you getting me the answers and so forth, and I had a little more time to read over it compared to the rest of the committee. Kind of two questions. One, specific to the I'm comparing what you submitted today with the email you sent me. Is there any information in the document you sent me that's other than that you address me by name and you put in the word, hey, you, once in a while, that would be, should I submit that letter for them? It reads a little easier, but I think it's the same information.
Chair, if I can represent, sorry, that's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to verify,
right.
So they have this.
Yeah, yes, that's correct. I mean, it's just one was a personal letter to you and one was the same information to the committee as a whole because you had all the questions.
All right, thank you. Follow up. Okay, and so I won't worry about doing that. And as you're representing the universe there, one of your statements made me think of another universal question. You mentioned that it's hard to know how many cases would have awarded over, you said 1.5 million, I think you meant the 500,000, because that's what we had currently compared to. It's hard to know, but you referenced, because so often they go to settlement, and your claim is that they lowball them. Have we seen a comparison to other states that are uncapped, what the average settlement amount in this sort of case is compared to our capped ones?
Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, on the first part of your question, if that's what I said, then I didn't quite say it correctly. On the first part of your question, there are two impacts, at least two impacts, of the $500,000 cap on non-economic damages. One impact is that the case is heard and the jury deliberates and the jury says, by God, this situation is such that this grieving family deserves to have $2 million. Mm-hmm. And the judge says, thank you very much for your time, but there's a cap on the non-economic damages. It's $500,000. So that's one subset. And then the other area where there's a problem is the case where there's the settlement offer that is an insult and an abomination and a trauma again for the family when they get that lowball offer because of the $500,000 cap. So those are two separate things and not.
Right.
Okay. And the second part of the question was how often does the does the case go to trial and the jury get the case and then the jury says, by gosh, it ought to be $2 million.
That's one question.
Right, and then it would get knocked down. I do not know the answer to that question.
But the second part, your claim is that the lowball settlement, that they're able to do a lowball settlement because there's a cap.
Yes.
And so settlements come in lower than the cap because they know they're not going to get more. And if that's the case, if we looked at other states that are uncapped, are we seeing that the average settlement amount is increasing a whole bunch, or is it staying there? What is the comparison?
So, Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, one dilemma on knowing the amounts of the final settlements is there's, in some cases, confidentiality agreements. And so, you know, our folks report that the offers are low.
Okay, no, it's helpful. It's good analysis. So let's see. First, Representative Nierman.
Good, thanks. Thank you, Chair Fagan. So, Mr. Towers, this is from your document today, mm-hmm. and you have four charts here that said how do physician premiums compare in Oregon, and you have the four different kind of medical specialties there, and they're all pretty similar. And so I'm looking at the OBGYN ones, but anyone will do. Mm-hmm. So you're comparing Oregon, which has a bar graph that's lower, and then states with caps, and it has a bar graph that's higher there. So it's showing that the states with caps have a higher average liability premium than Oregon. But Oregon is a state with a cap, and if this bill were to pass, Oregon would still be a state with a cap. So I'm wondering how this is significant. Go ahead and explain it.
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, excellent question. the big piece to remember is that on the vast majority of cases, there is no cap, because on the vast majority of cases, there are injuries, not death. And so that's why it's a very relevant comparison.
So no state has a cap on injuries. If I'm not a lawyer, right? Non-economic damages for injuries, is that true?
Representative Fagan and Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, I'm pretty sure that the states have caps on injuries. I know that Oregon used to, and so I believe the states have caps on injuries. I will verify that for you, but I believe that to be the case.
Can I follow one more time? So I'm just confused, because I was understanding, weren't we talking about like a 1999 Supreme Court case that invalidated caps on
under the Oregon Constitution?
Oh, just in Oregon. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. I think that's what I have. Thanks.
Questions? Representative Rayfield. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Fagan. Arthur, are non-economic damages the only compensation of plaintiff like Andrew Lane would receive?
So let me walk through how those damages work. So there are three types of damages. Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, there are three types of damages that a gentleman like Andrew Lane could receive. One is the non-economic, I'm sorry, let me start with the economic damages. So the economic damages would be if he had a medical bill before he passed away, is one type of economic damage. A second type of economic damage are lost wages. But as Mr. Block testified in the informational hearing, it's not all of his lost wages. So for instance, Mr. Lane's case, he cleaned gutters and siding for a living. So let's say he makes, I don't know, $13.50 an hour, just to pull a number out of thin air.
Where'd you get that number?
The amount that the family would be awarded is figured by accountants or economists or actuarials or whoever, is Mr. Block testified that the amount would be reduced by what he spends on himself.
Right.
And so if he spends $13.49 an hour on himself, then the one penny an hour would be the economic damages that he would receive, that his surviving families would receive. So that's the economic damages. And Representative Buehler, I have a sense that there may be a committee member that may be about to correct me on some of this stuff, but I'll keep on going until he does.
I see a squirming going on.
Yeah, on the non-economic damages, those are the damages that we talked about, that the families talked about, the idea of not having someone there to read to the kids, not having someone to care for an elderly parent, and not having someone to be there as a companion in life. You know, like a child who grows up without the childhood memories. Those are, of a parent who's been killed. That's the non-economic damages. Then the third piece are the punitive damages. And in Oregon, punitive damages don't come into play very often. And the reason the punitive damages don't come into play very often is that and again, I'm about to get into trouble here, but I'll keep on going. a big chunk of the punitive damages goes to a victim's compensation fund. And a smaller chunk, I want to say that's like half the punitive damage, then 15%, 10%, somewhere in there, goes to a fund to restore court facilities and for the operations of the court system. So that leaves the about 30-35% for the family, except that under IRS rules that those funds have to you pay taxes on the whole amount, on the whole 100%, and so much of the taxes goes to or much of the remainder goes to pay the taxes. And so it's pretty infrequent the case that punitive damages are heavily pursued. So that concludes my remark on that topic, unless I have a question from the dais.
Well, I mean, I'll just make, oh, go ahead. No, follow up, please.
So can you give me an idea, just, I know it's hard, back of an envelope, how much you'd expect a plaintiff like Andrew Lane to receive, or maybe that case has already been settled.
So Chair Fagan, Representative Beeler, really hard for me to get a sense on in a specific case, but again, if that situation, low wage worker, cap on non economics, you know, the low wage piece of it, so they would get compensated for the medical bill, they would get probably pennies on the dollar for lost wages, or penny, you know, literally a penny for the $13.50 or whatever he makes. And then a cap on the non-economics of $500,000. And so that's really what the family would be looking at, as I understand it.
Just a comment from me, that really underscores the testimony from Kate Newhall and Bob Jundeb earlier, because when you look at the minus consumption piece, when you're talking about a low-income worker, as we know because of other conversations that are happening in this building, a low-income worker is going to consume most of what they make, right? This is not somebody making $300,000 a year and having lots of excess and able to spend money on all kinds of things. This is, you know, somebody who's making $12 an hour is going to be consuming almost all, so there's hardly anything left. And then when we heard testimony that hasn't come up today, but there was questions in our informational hearing about, you know, to take a case like this all the way to trial, there could be $600,000 or $700,000 in costs. So you have somebody who's low income who has to go, okay, you know, I'm going to get very little, you know, in economic damages because my, you know, spouse essentially, you know, consumed a majority or is, you know, held to have consumed a majority of what he made. So very little economic damages. So basically the only kind of pot of money, you know, there's medical expenses, but those actually have to go to pay their medical expenses. So then all you're looking at is this $500,000 pot of money, and they have to go, okay, do I go to trial where I could end up racking up $700,000 in costs and walk away and end up owing $200,000 even if I win and get the full cap amount? I mean, this is part of the reason I just don't like the cap at all, because, you know, I feel like, I guess it's good if it's adjusted at least by inflation each year, so we're not coming back 20 years from now saying, you know, $1.5 million is putting people in this awful, and that's why I think the lowball settlement thing is something that is a real phenomenon. Again, I don't do this work, but it only makes sense that if you're going to somebody who's a low-wage worker and say, look, you know, I'll give you, you know, we'll give you $300,000, even though they maybe recognize it would have been a cap case at a jury, because the person's going to, okay, well, I can say no to that and risk going to trial and ended up coming out $200,000 in the hole after costs at trial. And so I think that this really underscores the economic damages or minus consumption, really underscores how this really affects low-income families and really makes it where they end up being the ones that take the lower settlements or take the amount of money that, you know, and I won't use hyperbolic language, but, you know, where they're the ones really being taken advantage of because they don't have this ability to go and entrust that they'll get a large economic damages award that can cover. Because, again, these, you know, in the end, this is just like a giant lump sum of money. It's not like, you know, I mean, there's ultimately just a big lump sum of money that's called certain, you know, that's cut out in different ways and probably taxed differently. I don't know all of that. But in the end, that's why you get low-income families who can't rely on a big economic damages award to cover some of those costs of going to trial. Because, you know, unlike a lot of other areas, like employment law, for example, even if somebody wins, they don't get to receive their costs and like either their costs of going to trial from the other side. So they have to still pay that out of whatever award they get. So that really underscores that point for me. Representative Beeler.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Arthur, you hearkened back to the golden years of some sort of bipartisan consensus making on these issues in the Oregon legislature, and used the settlement of $500,000 cap in 1987 as an example of that.
I'm sorry, Chair Fagan, Representative Beeler.
Oh, in 2009. Huh?
1.5. Right, Chair Fagan, Representative Beeler. In 2009, by a 55-4 vote, the Oregon House passed a bill that called for a $1.5 million cap. I think of the people here, we have one lucky participant, Representative Hulvey, who participated in that discussion and debate.
Do you know what the vote was in 87 when the cap was set at $500,000?
Chair Fagan, Representative Beeler, I do not. I don't know. Good question, though.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. From your Transformers. But follow up.
And how was that number arrived at?
Chair Fagan, Representative Beeler, I have no idea.
You weren't around even then?
In a word, no. But thanks for the comment.
Yeah, Representative Rayfield.
And just an offer to Representative Beeler. Some of the questions I think would be a lengthy conversation here. There's a lot of dynamics of things, but I'd be more than happy to spend, you know, an hour or two in my office kind of going, actually, if you really want to know the data, really looking into it and understanding it better. So,
maybe a couple hours on the floor.
Chair Fagan,
yes.
Representative Rayfield, thank you so much for your comment on the quality of my testimony.
Yeah. All right, that looks like no more questions. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, thank you so much for your serious consideration of the issue, for raising the issue, for looking at this thing, for asking the tough question. I appreciate that.
And Brian wanted to come back up, so you can go ahead and go, Arthur, if you'd like, unless you want to stay. We have a little...
No. Chair Fagan, I really apologize. Brian Beringer again from the OMA for coming up. That's against my rules. But there was something I just wanted to say. The data that was just presented, I just got a chance to see that right during the hearing. And so I believe during the informational, the very wise chair made the observation that we're both advocates on both sides of this issue and that data sometimes represents those advocates. And so I might suggest that the committee, the state has an Oregon Health Policy Board. They have a workforce committee. There's the Oregon Workforce Healthcare Workforce Institute that are all state entities, and I think they would be a little shocked to hear some of, I think, the rural data that was presented today, because it's tough how the numbers are, and I think Representative Beeler sort of teased that out when you have to look at specialties and obstetrics. And so if you want a completely unbiased from OMA or from the trial lawyers, I would suggest go to the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Workforce Committee.
All right, thank you for that.
And Chair Fagan, I would say I went right to these are documents in the that are drawn right from the Oregon Medical Board for whatever that's worth.
And I apologize. I didn't mean to impugn that. It's just that it's tricky data, and that's I think that's what Dr. Beeler was suggesting too. So when you look at the specialties, when you look at the retirement rates, those are the data and reports that have been cranked out of the Oregon Health Policy Board, a state group that has been working on this. So
thank you, Representative Rayfield.
And I'd love to look at that data. Is there like a parallel agency or group that would have those numbers for states that don't have the caps, like Washington or Arizona, Wyoming, or any of the other states?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair, I think so. I assume they have health policy, healthcare OHA type entities in their states.
Okay, so we can try and find that.
Right, and Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, I would, again, getting apples to apples is. It's what it is. According to the physician numbers from Physician Characteristics and Distribution 2015 from the AMA, Oregon has 357 physicians per 100,000 compared to 301 in states with caps. And again, argue till the cows come home. This chart on the next on the very last page comes from the AMA.
Did you have a?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Thank
all right.
You.
Well, thank you, everyone, for being patient. That was very helpful.
The data committee.
And we are not going to work this today, so we'll have an opportunity to have more discussion on it. So before I close the hearing, though, is there anything anybody would like to say in general before I close the hearing? Any comments not directed at a panel?
Do we have floor tonight?
No.
All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4136, and I'm going to carry over the work session to Thursday. And anything else for the good of the order? All right, with that, I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.